You're listening to the Hockey Podcast Network. New shows every day. Find us at thehockeypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Welcome to the San Jose Hockey Now podcast, your trusted source for all things San Jose Sharks on the Hockey Podcast Network. My name is Nick Flora. Joining me, as always, this late Thursday night, beautiful Thursday night, unless you're a Giants fan, Shang Peng, editor-in-chief of San Jose Hockey Now, and of course, my co-host.
But it's a pretty good day if you're from L.A.
Yeah, I think we just soiled everyone's morning. Well, no, I think the first base umpire soiled everyone's last night and morning. But
can't admit that was a bad call.
Yeah, he did not go. Even an A's fan and an Angels fan sitting here in agreement on a call against with a Giants and Dodgers game. But I digress. Welcome to the San Jose Hockey Now podcast, where we don't talk about baseball. We talk about Sharks hockey. On today's episode, we give the most recent updates on the Vander Kane saga, because everyone's so excited about that information, of course. Then we take a deep dive, well, a semi-deep dive, into the Knyazhov injury situation and what that means for the Sharks kind of moving forward, and especially for the D pairings, you know, starting this season. Then we're going to tackle some under-the-radar questions and our Megalodon questions, some big questions that are going to determine the majority of which way the Sharks season kind of goes, if it's trending up or if it's going to be, well, you can't go any further down than where they were last year, so if it's just going to be stagnant. After our Sharks talk, we have an incredible interview with the San Jose Sharks inaugural season first-round pick, Pat Faloon.
Yeah, and Pat Faloon was a great guy to talk to. He, like William Eklund this Saturday, was the rare San Jose Sharks player to play in the NHL right after he was drafted. You know, Faloon was drafted in 1991, stepped right into the lineup for the 1991-92 Sharks expansion season. And there's just a little more than a handful of these guys out there. We've talked about this before. Faloon was one of them, of course. Patrick Marleau, Jeff Friesen, Vlastimil Krupa, Ray Whitney, and Milan Mihalik. And Eklund will be joining that group. Again, the rare Sharks player to play in the NHL in the season, in the year right after he was drafted. And so we're going to ask Pat Faloon what it was like to be a teenager in the NHL with sort of the weight of the franchise seemingly on him.
All right, before we get into that, we're going to give a quick shout-out to our social media handles. You can follow the podcast at SJ Hockey Now Pod. You can follow the network at HockeyPodNet. And you can follow myself at @NickFloor_. Shang?
You can find me at @Shang_Pang.
And all your work at SanJoseHockeyNow.com, of course.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, I forgot.
Don't worry. I got your back, Shang. So let's just hop right into the fun bits, I guess. The Sharks unveiled their opening night roster, and to no one's surprise, Evander Kane was absent from the list. He was counted as a non-rostered player, but the biggest surprise came when fans and all people alike, especially all over hockey Twitter, found out that since Evander Kane is currently under investigation, his salary does not count toward the cap hit. So where the broke Sharks suddenly are rich and plentiful with $8 million in cap space per cap friendly. And then, of course, the questions start rolling in, Shang. Oh, we should just go out and try to trade for Jack Eichel, or we need to go find someone to bolster up this roster. And that's not necessarily how that can work. There's a lot of ins and outs, especially because he's still under investigation. But a big chunk of news came out, which was actually written on SanJoseHockeyNow.com. I believe it was from National Hockey Now. It was the one that did the big nationwide article on it. But Nick Kyprios at Real, I think it's Kipper or Kuiper. I'm not sure if that's pronounced.
Yeah, Kuiper. Yeah, K-Y-P-E-R. Real K-Y-P-E-R.
Yeah, he tweeted out October 12th. Now, again, we are recording this on Thursday night, late night. We're talking late night. You're going to be listening to this on Friday morning on your way you know, home, work, whichever, or at work. Get back to work. It sounds like the NHL is leaning towards suspending San Jose Sharks Kane under supplementary discipline 18-18A of the CBA. After serving his set amount of games, it's likely he'll be clear to resume his career. I think it's a funny thing that he said the word resume his career and not season. That implies a lot of what ifs that came to my head initially. You know, how long could this suspension be? I looked up 18A of the CBA and it's off ice conduct. So obviously this is going towards that vaccination card and what sort of rules he's breaking via Gary Bettman. So a lot of questions kind of came up with this, Shane. Can you what kind of piqued your interest when you saw this?
Well, that also can go toward he's also under investigation for sexual assault, domestic mm-hmm. battery, so not just for a fake COVID vaccination card.
Yeah.
Anyway, though, it's hard to say what this means because we don't know how long if this occurs as Kypreos has laid out that he'll be suspended and then he'll be able to resume his career. We don't know how long that's going to be for, so we have no idea how long this cap space exists for the Sharks, you know, if this is just sort of a illusion. Mm-hmm. And so I get accused from time to time on Facebook, especially, of writing clickbait articles. And I'm not sure if the people there know exactly what clickbait means. But I will confess, though, that I wrote a clickbaity title. I wrote a story about the cap space, and I titled it, Eichel Anybody? But, of course, and as I mentioned in the article, that was just a tongue-in-cheek thing. And so, and as you mentioned, Nick, there's a whole ton of obstacles between the Sharks acquiring Jack Eichel with Evander Kane's salary cap space. So I think the first thing we need to figure out is, at least on the hockey side of things, is how many games is he going to be suspended if he is suspended? And so it's a lot of we'll see, which means that we're still going to have a lot more Evander Kane news to come. And who knows? We may have it as soon as when you guys are listening to this on Friday.
Yeah, there's just too many question marks or questions in this situation and not enough answers from the league side. And, you know, from a fan's perspective, it can be frustrating and annoying to just constantly have this lingering issue just kind of stuck on you. I'm sure Sharks fans just want this ball and chain kind of cut off so they can move on. But we'll, like you said, we'll see. We are still waiting for the silver bullet. We're still waiting for something to show up on this news front. So I'm done talking about it again. I think every time that we've brought up Evander Kane on the show, I think I've ended the segment with, I'm done talking about Evander Kane.
Well, you're going to be talking about it a lot more yet, so that would be my guess.
I think we kept it to like 5 minutes, so I'm okay with that. moving forward, the big thing or the under-the-radar kind of tip-of-the-iceberg subliminal news that came out involving Nikolai Knyazhov. Bob Bugner was asked if Knyazhov was still trending up, and to which he replied, not really. So In the NHL world, it's just a UBI and an LBI world. It's upper body injury, it's week to week, it's lower body injury. Like, nothing makes any sense out there. We never get timetables. Any other NHL coach would say something along the lines of, oh yeah, we're closely monitoring the situation right now. He's currently rehabbing. We're hoping to get him back soon. Luckily, Bob's a little bit more forthcoming with information. He's more honest, more upfront from what I've noticed. So we can now focus at the problem at hand is Knyazhov's timetable is significantly longer than we had hoped at the start of training camp. So what does this mean for the D pairs moving forward? You know, who do we expect to be the partner for Erik Karlsson on opening night? Is it going to be Šimek? Is it going to be Vlasic? Or is it going to be Hataka?
Yeah, I think the big thing I took from what Bob said about Knyazhov, and there's a lot to take from it, but he referenced that injury as being long-term. Whatever Knyazhov is suffering, it's a lower body injury, and that's all we know about it. Mm-hmm. But he said it too. He said both Knyazhov and Veal's injuries were long-term. And Veal's injury, he actually gave a timeline to of a month. And so Knyazhov, you know, when you say long term, that could mean anything, right? It could mean, as Bob just sort of suggested, it could be a month, it could be 6 months. You know, what we do know about Knyazhov is that yesterday he went to go see a specialist outside of San Jose for his injury. Not a good sign, of course. And we have no sense of kind of how long he will be out. And so now we talk about who is going to replace him next to Erik Karlsson. And I addressed that a bit a couple days ago. I had an article titled Three Under the Radar Sharks Questions. And the three questions were, a couple of them are forward related. Will Timo Meier finally break out? Who's going to play with Nick Bonino and why does it matter? And the third question is relevant to Karlsson and his partner. Where is Mark-Edward Vlasic's game at? And I think that we have seen in this preseason so far that his game is not at the level that you hope for the money he's making. And I think he will be better than he was last year. He was bad enough last year, Vlasic, I'm saying, to be dropped to the bottom pairing. But I don't know if it's going to be good enough for a top four role again. And one of the reasons why I can kind of say that, besides watching him during the preseason, and granted, he only played a couple of games, but with Knyazhov's injury, it would seem to be a clear, open path for somebody to skate with Erik Karlsson. And you would give it to somebody that you thought belonged in a top four, in theory, if you're the coaching staff. You know, one of the adages about coaches that's usually true is that coaches know to play good players.
Usually.
And so if Vlasic was Vlasic circa 2016 or Vlasic circa 2019, he'd be a shoo-in next to Karlsson. There wouldn't even be a moment's thought about that. Mm-hmm. That there is a moment's thought about it, and that Erik Karlsson has skated in camp with not really Šimek, but with Vlasic, with Hataka, with Middleton, signals that the Sharks have about, and I'll count Šimek in this, they have about $9 million devoted to two defensemen that can't take a top four job in a pinch. And that's a huge, huge problem. And as I wrote in my Knyazhov injury article, you know, this indecisiveness in your top four is decidedly not a good sign heading into your season opener. And so this is a huge, huge problem.
Yeah, that's Shang, that's not a good sign for the Sharks moving forward. The more times we bring up money involving the Sharks' defensive pairings, the more heartbreak I feel. I think we even mentioned it with Mike McKenna, like just between Vlasic, Karlsson, as well as Brent Burns is $26.5 million there, and it just hurts really, really bad to know that the guy is getting paid that much money to play defense. In Vlasic's case, cannot secure that top four role for the Sharks, and it's just hurting them day in and day out, all of last season, all the season before, and it doesn't show any signs of stopping. So,
if mentioning Karlsson, Burns, and Vlasic's contract might be considered gut punches for you, the Sharks fan, at least mentioning Chimik's contract is more like a little pinch, at least.
Yeah, sure. It's 2.25, still doesn't feel good. It's like, oh, I got stabbed. That punch in the arm doesn't feel that bad anymore. you actually had articulated out or tweeted out the Sharks lines this morning. Big news coming out. Gajewicz finally showed up. We're just going to touch really quickly on this. This is huge for the Sharks. They were having a lot of visa issues. This is an extra player that the Sharks claimed off of waivers, a former second-round pick. We've talked about it before. He's going to take a little bit of time to work with the guys. Whether or not he can slot into that bottom six role somewhere is to be determined. But as of right now, the biggest thing is we see Dahlin and we see Eklund on the top six. So we know that are the young guys that we're bringing in, some very young kids from overseas, are going to be seeing some top line minutes in the NHL against a very good team and the Winnipeg Jets. So that's something Sharks fans can look forward to this Saturday. And just as a heads up, if you are going to the game this Saturday, make sure that you have your proof of vaccination good to go and sign up for the Clear app, because I'm not trying to wait in that line forever. Y'all need to hurry up, okay? Like, I'm going to have lunch with my wife over in San Jose. I'm not trying to be late into the game, okay? So make sure you guys got your stuff all taken care of on that front. So, Shane, we got a little segment here for the listeners. It's called the Megalodon Questions. We were going with many nicknames, right? We had Burning Questions.
Turning Point Questions.
Oh, yeah, Turning Point, but that just left a really bad taste in our mouth for reasons not to be mentioned, as well as just big questions. But we decided we're going to take a shark's turn on it and go Megalodon Questions here. And these are going to be questions that I'm sure Sharks fans are asking themselves in the inside of their head, but it might not be articulated out there for people to get an answer to. So that's what we're going to do for you guys here. I'm going to ask these questions. Shane's going to give his answer. I'll give a little follow-up. But these are the biggest things that can help make or break the Sharks season in the, you know, this coming year. So the first question, I mentioned it a little bit earlier. Can Dahlin and Eklund deliver in the top six?
Yep. And if you think about it, a lot depends on these two rookies. If they succeed, you suddenly have actually very solid forward depth for once with the Sharks. You know, you can have a third line that features, as it does now, Kevin LeBanc. And remember, Kevin LeBanc scored 56 points, I think, with Joe Thornton on the third line a couple years ago. And you can also have a Rudy Balzers on your third line. That's where Balzers started camp. Balzers was actually on the line to start camp with Bonino and LeBanc. And that is an excellent-looking third line. Mm-hmm. That's all the fantasy stuff. The reality of it is that it's a real stretch to expect two rookies to step into your top six and contribute immediately. The last time there were two rookie 20-goal scorers on the same team was 2006-07 in Pittsburgh, Evgeny Malkin with 33 and Jordan Staal with 29. Even 40-plus points by two rookies on the same team is unusual. The most recent, 2016-17, Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. So all four of these guys that I've mentioned, these are all lottery pick types. In the case of Dahlin and Eklund, only Eklund is that, of course. But needless to say, this is a very, very tall order. A ton of pressure to put on your two rookies to start the season. If they bomb, suddenly you have two huge holes to fill in your top six. And sure, you can get a Kevin LeBanc or a Barrett Bonhoff to fill those holes, but then who's on your third line? You know, who's on your third line that's designed around Nick Bonino to play the best players on the other team and take the line share of the defensive zone faceoffs? So, yeah, this is, I think, a very big gamble that the Sharks are taking. Maybe they don't have much of a choice, I'll say it feels better than it has the last couple of seasons when they were trying to roll, you know, Gregor on the third line or Daniil Yertykin wherever in the lineup a couple of years ago. But I think Eklund and Dahlin have shown a bit more. But it's still, as I noted with some of the stats that I pulled up and how unlikely it is to have a couple rookie 20-goal scorers or a couple 40-point scorers on the same team. It's a tall, tall order.
Yeah, and it would take a hefty amount of magic. That's the only thing that I can really think of. It boils down to just magic and timing. I mean, you're talking about 20 goal scorers and Malkin and Jordan Staal, and then you think in your head, you know, Jonathan Dahlin as well as William Eklund. That's like you said, it's a tall order. It's more than a tall order for two rookies to come out and do that for the Sharks on a team that has just been tumbling down since the 2019 season. It's going to take a lot of veteran, what's the word I'm thinking, resurrections, essentially, I feel, to help them get to that point.
Sure.
Right? And it's and like you said, it could make or break whether or not Tomas Hertl stays. So that's another thing that a lot of this is riding on. So whether or not they can or can't do that is to be seen. If I was a betting man, I would bet no. But yeah, it's just unfortunate.
Yeah, that's one thing to note. You know, we're going to talk to Pat Filun in a little bit. And Pat Filun had to deal with a lot of pressure coming to expansion franchise, being their very first draft pick, being the number two pick of a draft right after Eric Lindros. But Pat Filun did not have to do anything to keep a star player like Tommy Hurdle around. So that's a kind of interesting pressure that Eklund, you know, it's not going to be said, not going to be mentioned. But I do believe, and I wrote a little about this in regards to Hurdle, that I think Hurdle wants to stay. Hurdle has talked many times about how he started a family in San Jose. He's played 500 games here. He loves the fans. He loved the locker room up to the last couple of years. I think he wants to stay, but he wants to win too. And both things may not happen in San Jose, obviously. Obviously, the winning part is in serious question with all these long, difficult contracts that the Sharks have. And so to keep Hurdle, you need to give him hope. You need to give Hurdle hope. And that hope could be in a William Eklund or a Jonathan Dahlin. But again, though, that's a lot of pressure to put on them.
What I think would be hilarious is if they find success. I know we're running off on a tangent here really quick. Is if Dahlin and Eklund find just an inkling amount of success and they put them both on Tommy Hurdle's line.
Nice.
So it's just like pressure from both angles, fighting a war on two fronts. You're going to say no now, Tommy?
Yeah, the two young kids, yeah.
Yeah. Please.
Exactly.
But the Tomas Hurdle front, the contract, I'm gonna put it out there in the world. It feels way too similar to the Pavelski situation for me. So I'm going in expecting the absolute worst, so that way if something good happens, I am surprised for the better. And I think that's just kind of where all the Sharks fans mentalities are kind of at with these last couple seasons.
Yeah,
we're just gonna expect
fair.
The worst. If good things happen, we're gonna be surprised, and it's not gonna be a bad time. So next little bullet point on our Megalodon questions, and I think this is definitely worthy of being put on this segment. Who will play net front on the power play? Shane, you actually had just tweeted out Thursday. Again, we're recording this Thursday night, but you tweeted out the two power play units that were essentially being deployed during that practice. And we're assuming this is what they're going to try in the opening night on Saturday. But yeah, go ahead and break it down for everyone.
Yep. So on one unit, they had Burns, Meyer, Dahlin, Couture playing the high slot or bumper area, and Nick Bonino net front. And Nick Bonino is actually a very good net front person. I think there's a lot of questions of, oh, Nick Bonino not thought of as a big scorer. But he is very secure in that position. It's the other unit where I'm not so sure about the net front presence there. So the second unit is Carlson, Eklund, LeBanc, Hurdle in your bumper high slot, and Jasper Weatherby as your net front person. And my questions, with Weatherby is obviously he's a rookie, and he obviously has not played net front at this high a level. And I think the immediate response in terms of, well, why don't you just put, you know, shift to Timo Meier from the other unit, put him in front of the net. You know, you can just, you know, you can put any skill. Why don't you play Tommy Hurdle net front? Net front is a kind of a special kind of position on the power play. And there's a reason why Nick Bonino was brought in, and specifically that's his role. Even though Nick Bonino, I'm not sure if he's even scored 20 goals in his career. But specifically, net front is a specific job. I wrote about this a couple months ago. I wrote about Nick Bonino being on the power play because I put two and two together there. Bob Bugner at the end of last year said that that's one of the areas he wanted to improve on the power play. And when they signed Nick Bonino, I did some research and I realized that Bonino was a big part of Minnesota's power play playing the net front. He had a lot of success there. And so I talked to an NHL coach in general about what a net front guy has to do. And it's not just simply score goals. If you think that's all Joe Pavelski did net front, then you are mistaken. If you think, you know, Evander Kane played a lot of net front and he scored some goals there. But I think that, you know, when Bob Bugner talked about at the end of last season wanting to improve net front, he was talking about Evander Kane too. And he wasn't just talking about Kane's production. which I think Netfront has been okay. You know, actually, 2 years ago, he had a really good year on the power play, at least in terms of production. But it's not just about goals scored. So this is what the NHL head coach said to me about what he wants out of a good Netfront person. And not all of this is about that player scoring. He said, he needs to be good at using his size and awareness to take the goalie's eyes away. He has to make the goalie work. He must have really good hand-eye coordination to deflect and tip pucks, put them in play on the goalie. He's got to understand the power play system, when to screen, when to roll away as a backdoor option. He's got to play the goal line and be a passing option who can roll out to stuff it or make a quick pass to the slot or the back door. Basically, when a player is in front of the net there, you know, if the moment calls for it, can he attack the net quick with the puck, be quicker than the defenseman trying to get at him? Or can he react and make a quick pass back to the slot, or if somebody is walking down the slot in the back door? So it's a position that this coach says that requires skill, smarts, and good reads. And to go back to, it's not as simple as just scoring goals. It's not just the guy that scores goals there. It's a guy that can make the power play better, basically. Make the power play better by making the goalie work, right? Taking away the goalie's eyes. Even the hand-eye coordination to deflect and tip pucks, obviously, ideally, when you tip a puck net front, it goes past the goalie, you score a goal. But even just getting a good tip and that trouble, right, that chaos you create in the net with that tip, because chances are if you tip the puck on a goalie and the goalie makes the save, the goalie won't be able to stop the puck, though. It's probably going to go off some part of the goalie. It's going to be a rebound somewhere, and that's really important. So, again, you know, Netfront is not just simply about putting your most skilled guy there. Otherwise, a guy like Timo Meier, you know, why hasn't he been Netfront? Well, it's because I don't think he's really that great at that position, at the Netfront position. These little subtle things, you know, are things that aren't the forte of his game. I think Timo is a shooter-first kind of guy. He's a volume shooter. I think we might actually say the same about Evander Kane. Evander Kane is more of a volume shooter than these kind of little things. I don't know if he's as strong at. So anyway, I think this is a very important role for the Sharks to figure out beyond Nick Bonino. I'm not sure if Jasper Weatherby is going to be the answer for a lot of the reasons why we mentioned, just his youth and inexperience at it. Mm-hmm. One guy that I think actually you mentioned may turn out to be sort of a sleeper guy for it is Jonah Gajewicz. And Gajewicz, of course, waiver claim, et cetera, et cetera. You know, let's not expect too much out of him. But his skill set all throughout juniors and even in the AHL, was net front guy on the power play. That's specifically the one thing that he's supposed to be quite good at. And so can he be somebody that can help the power play, specifically net front? And I think it's very, very possible, especially if you consider who else has been net front on the power play for the Sharks this preseason, right? And like I said, Bonino's job is safe. But beyond that, we've seen Weatherby in games. We've seen Lane Peterson in practice. So this isn't Joe Pavelski or Thomas Holmstrom that Jonah Gajewicz is trying to take a job front, at least on the power play. So I can see Gajewicz getting a very serious look on a power play unit net front, see if it takes. He's not going to get, you know, so much rope. He's not going to get a whole season to show his stuff. But I can see him getting some good run there.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if you use Pavelski as a pinnacle type of top-tier, highest echelon level of net front power play specialist, because in my opinion, he was. The biggest thing was he was the best tipper in the league. He also had... you can just go down the list and you can just check every single box. He wasn't gigantic, but he knew how to use his size. He had awareness. And the thing that it boils down to is like hockey IQ. And I don't want to take anything away from Timo Meier in the sense that he is just an athlete. He really is a great athlete and a great hockey player, but you got to have a specific skill set to be in that net front package, like you had said. Kind of like a tight end in the NFL. They're not scoring the most touchdowns you know, but you have your couple of guys who are the best. But there's the intangibles that they have to do, mainly physically, because you're in the dirty area of the ice, per se. So you have to go out there. You have to do the intangibles that don't show up on the score sheet to allow the power play to be successful.
Hey, one thing you mentioned, Pavelski, that I'd love, I wish was tracked, is everyone focuses on the goals that Pavelski scored, and you should, and he was the best. He is the best at the league in that. Mm-hmm. But what about the shots that didn't go in but caused chaos that led to goals, be it on the very next play or later in the shift because it got the goalie moving all over the place, right? These are kind of the little things that are missed if you concentrate just on the amount of goals that were scored. And that's the area, again, you know, why is Nick Bonino, why is your third line center on the power play? Well, this is why, these kind of little things. Why is Weatherby on it right now? Well, they're hoping that he can do enough of these little things to be a positive force on the power play. But it's a whole different job, again, net front, as opposed to where Erik Karlsson or Brent Burns play on the point. Mm-hmm. Or along the wall where William Eklund or Kevin LeBanc play. Totally different jobs.
Yeah, exactly. So I like Weatherby being there just because of how he played at UND. He fits the bill in the sense, and he's got the IQ to hopefully grow in that role, but I don't personally see him taking that role over for the good, unless he just shows out. Like, there's a possibility. Of course, there's always a percentage chance that he comes in and just absolutely kills it in that role. But I'm interested to see if who else can slot into those roles for the Sharks, and can they be better than him? So, moving to the next question, new haircut, who this? Will the real Erik Karlsson please stand up? Take it away, Shane.
Well, you guys, everybody listening, have every reason to doubt Erik Karlsson. It's been 2 years. Yeah, 2 years. 2 years since we've seen Norris caliber play from him. But the Sharks, obviously, the way they're constructed, the salary cap is limiting them, right? It's not the NFL. They can't just cut Erik Karlsson with no penalty. They probably would have done so already, to be honest, if this was the NFL. You're stuck with them, basically. And your hope, the team's hopes, you know, are raised up with him, or they drown with him, you know, depending on where his game is at, where his groin is at, where his ankle is at, whatever, right? It all depends on that, right? And yeah. So let's just face that reality. You're not just getting rid of him. So with that in mind, what Bob Bugner said about Karlsson's camp today was interesting. And don't want to give out too much false hope, of course, but it does sound different than what's been said in the past. And this is what Bob said. Again, he said this Thursday afternoon. He came in ready with a purpose this year. In the past, whether it was injuries or maybe he took his foot off the gas pedal, coasted through camp a little bit like some veterans do from time to time.
And, you know, just really quick, Shang, I wanted to point out that I've gone on the record before to say that I feel like injury offseason after injury offseason for Erik Karlsson has really hampered his camps. What I saw in the final preseason game against Vegas was pretty good. He was pretty damn good. I don't want to, like, overhype it up. I just wanted to slot this in here really quick. He made, on the power play goal from, or on the goal from Jonathan Dahlin, he made a behind-the-back pass that just, yeah, I just feel like I was in 2019 again. But it was, that quote right there is huge for me. Because I said this was going to be his very first time in a San Jose Sharks uniform coming into camp without an off-season surgery. He's going to come in with a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't want to go through a rebuild. And to me, he's shown it in the games with and how he's played. So just wanted to put that out there.
Let's hope so. Karlsson had great games last year, too, and I wrote about some of those great games. So let's not totally discount his season last year as if he was bad from games 1 through 56. So he had good games last year, so I'm not going to take a good game here and there and say that's enough from him. obviously, with the money he makes and the expectation, he needs to be good, you know, 90% of the time. I don't know. So he has to be a lot better than good, you know, one out every like five games or so, which was kind of what he was last year. But Bugner also said that he told Brent Burns and Erik Karlsson this, and he told them, as you get older, it becomes much harder just to turn a switch on when it matters. Both guys have done a really good job with that account. And so, again, you know, I don't want to put out too much false hope. We've seen 2 years of a substandard Erik Karlsson. Karlsson just turned 31. There's every reason to believe. And obviously, you know, people from Vegas, gambling, you know, most people believe that this downward trend will continue. And so it's likely to continue. Just honestly, that's what the odds are, right? But the Sharks, as the cap situation dictates, they have him. And so hope for the best and hope that these kind of little things that Bob is saying and the little things that you're saying, Nick, you know, like that, yeah, that fancy behind the back pass to Timo Meier that went to Dahlin for Dahlin's first preseason goal, that kind of stuff is more consistent and more regular this season. It will make a huge difference for sure.
And I will go on to say that there were multiple occasions last season. Again, I don't want to just sit here and make excuses for Erik Karlsson because he's getting paid $11.5 million to be the best player on this team, essentially. There were multiple occasions where an amazing stretch pass to a Dylan Gambrell and they just couldn't corral the puck, or a Joachim Blichfeldt in his short stint, or a Noah Gregor, a name that we dropped so consistently with youth that did not live up to expectation. So it seems like the excuses there's no more. You can't have any more excuses. There's no injuries. You have, in my opinion, a deeper Sharks team this year than the two previous years, just based on the guys that have been sent down to the Barracuda compared to who's on the roster now with Nick Bonino and Andrew Cogliano. So what did you say for Ryan Merkley? For me, it's that way for Erik Karlsson. It's a shit or get off the pot year for him, because it feels like if it doesn't trend up at all this year, we're just going to be stuck with that contract and that production level throughout the rest of his contract.
Yeah, what I said with Merkley was that it was kind of a make or break year, not with his contract because he has 2 years left, but it was a break year for his reputation.
Yeah, that's
and
what I was kind of
you can to. Argue that with Karlsson too. Karlsson has been, you know, 2 years away from his best play, but unfortunately, though, he has, unlike Merkley, Karlsson has 6 years left on his contract. So, yeah, potentially 6 more years of excuses to look forward to.
Yuck! Yeah.
Don't
like. I'm getting a tongue scraper. I'm gonna just rip this out of my taste buds really quick. Our next and final Megalodon question, and this is something that we recently spoke about, but we're going to bring it up again because it is one of the more crucial and most talked about points for Sharks fans last year going into this season. Can Aiden Hill help Sharks fans get over the Martin Jones hangover?
And yeah, with the point of these questions is these are rather obvious Sharks questions. You know, will Erik Karlsson be good? Can the goaltending be better with Aiden Hill? But to kind of add like a fresh perspective to it all. And so looking at the Sharks last year, their team save percentage was 891, tied for second to last in the league. So let's just do some math here. Let's say Aiden Hill and James Reimer can get the Sharks to league average. That was the Maple Leafs last year, by the way, who were 15th in the NHL with a 905 save percentage, above 90%. Imagine that, Sharks fans. So the difference between 891 and 905, if you apply it to the Sharks, the shots that they saw last year, it's a lot of goals. It's 26 goals less allowed. That's a big amount. And let's combine that with let's say the Sharks, and we talked about the power play a little bit. Let's say the Sharks' power play can get back to average. And last year in the NHL, that was about a 20.5% clip. That was a slightly above average power play. The Sharks, of course, last season scored at a 14.1% clip, 29th in the league. Do you have any noises, Nick?
I want to save the viewers.
You're
my gag, mouth
you're
noises.
Gagged out. It's dry heaving now.
Yep, I'm toast.
So, the difference between a 14.1% power play and a 20.5, looking at the Sharks' attempts last year, is 10 goals scored. Okay, so suddenly the Sharks' goal differential, if you add in league average goaltending, about average-ish power play, the Sharks' goal differential was a minus 50 last year. So big heave there. But if you add in better the average goaltending, the math I calculated, and an average power play, suddenly the goal differential is a minus 14. Not amazing. That's not a cup contender by any stretch. But it's worth noting that the Canadians, the Stanley Cup finalist Canadians, they made it into the playoffs with a minus 7 goal differential. So you start to kind of get, you know, again, average goaltending, average power play, maybe a little better at 5-on-5, and suddenly your goal differential is somewhere close to even, which is roughly a playoff team.
And you got to kind of figure that these stats play into each other. You know, it's the snowball effect, essentially, where one bad thing can lead to other bad things, right? And so if you change one thing incrementally, yeah, it can change other things here and there. But the Sharks' goaltending room was not an incremental change. That was a full overhaul. That was a complete R&R of the entire goaltending room. And we talked about that with Mike McKenna on last week's episode. And, you know, we asked him if it was an upgrade or if it was just a lateral move. And he's just like, well, I mean, look. And we talked about the different numbers, and we talked about the high danger save percentage chances and all these different things that equates to success at the goaltending position. And he had his criticisms and his, like, you know, pump the brakes on the Aiden Hill hype train type of talk there. But at the end of the day, we felt like it was an upgrade. The Sharks goaltending room was a slight upgrade.
Well, anything would be an upgrade.
Exactly. Getting back to average could snowball affect the Sharks to success. You know, it starts, and we talked about it before recording. I said, to me, there was a lot of pressure or a lot of emphasis put on the bottom six, and you countered with the top six and how it starts there and it goes down. And you have more depth when you can move players down, like you mentioned earlier. And if you can trust the goaltender behind you, you can play your game a little bit more safe and sound. And all, you know, it's all, and I'm going to make a really stupid pun here. It's all like the inner workings of a mechanism, right? So humans' inner workings are like bones, sure. You know, if we're not talking about organs, right? A clock is cogs, right? So the Sharks literally went out and got bones and cogs to help the inner workings of
that's actually
team.
Pretty good. I'm going to give you that one. I actually didn't see that coming, so.
They literally got Nick Bonino and Andrew Cogliano, bones and cogs, to help the inner workings of their team to put a better product on the ice for the Sharks. So, I think we are going to improve. I don't think it might be a drastic improvement compared to the rest of the teams in the division, but a good stride is better than no stride in this case.
So. The Sharks 2021-22. Let's get back to average.
Let's not be bad. But I think that pretty much, I think it wraps it up for us here to talk about the Sharks. And you know, we mentioned earlier in the show, we have an amazing interview lined up with Pat Filun. He took time out of his day to sit down and talk with us, and it was honestly a blast. Before we get into that interview, of course, we do have to thank this week's sponsor, as always, DraftKings. Another week of the NFL season means another shot to win big at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers can bet just $1 on any NFL game and win $100. That doesn't sound as good as $1 million. You know, I was going to do the pinky thing. In free bets if either team scores a point. The last 0-0 tie in the NFL was in 1943. So I'd say this is probably a no-brainer. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, DraftKings won't leave you empty-handed. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes all season long with DraftKings daily fantasy sports contests. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now, use promo code THPN, throw down $1 on any NFL game, and win $100 in free bets if either team scores a point. That's promo code THPN this week at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit and $1 wager required. One per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. And without further ado, here's our amazing interview with Pat Falloon. And joining us today on the podcast is a farmer from Fox Warren, Manitoba. Okay, I'm lying just a little bit. He's not just a farmer. He was also the San Jose Sharks' very first draft pick in franchise history in 1991. Ladies and gentlemen, we bring to you Pat Falloon. Pat, how's your day going so far?
Well, boys, it's going pretty well so far. So far, so good. Yeah, it seems like an eon ago that took place. But, yeah, it's part of history now for sure.
And speaking of Fox Warren, Pat, you know, a couple hundred people there. And I wonder, you know, you were called the pride of Fox Warren in many articles that I've read. You had your picture hung up in a local hotel when you were 15.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wonder, was that hard to live up to that pressure?
That's a good question. I don't know. I guess I never really thought of it that way. You know, when you're that age, you're young. I left home when I was 15 to go play junior hockey, and pressure is just what came with playing. I never really thought of it as pressure. You know, I just had a dream as a kid to play in the NHL, and I was fortunate enough to make it come true.
And I guess it wasn't that much pressure because, hey, you came back home to live, right?
Yeah, I came back to where I started from, but what a whirlwind tour! I tell you, it was incredible. Very fortunate to have had that opportunity, and you know, memories are just incredible to me. So, you know, it's just part of my being, I guess, to have accomplished those things.
So you were drafted second overall by the Sharks, as I just said, their first draft pick ever. You had a great camp. That was, that's obvious. And you were one of the best players on the team that got you onto the Sharks as an 18-year-old. Very few people can do that after their draft year. And, you know, funny enough, just this season, William Eklund, Sharks' seventh overall pick, that's exactly what has happened to him, too. He's had an amazing camp, an amazing preseason. And now this coming Saturday, it's the real deal. Opening night against your favorite team, the Winnipeg Jets, to be you know, funny enough there. But I want to ask you, what was that adjustment like back in 1991 from the preseason to opening night and the real deal?
Well, from what I recall, you know, I went to camp with an open mind. I hadn't signed a contract. And as camp started and progressed, they ended up, Jack Farrar was a GM and talked with my agent or whatever, and it seemed that I was going to be able to perhaps make the team. So it was just a matter of getting the contract signed. And once I signed that, I was good to go. Very, very nervous, I guess. Ended up, I missed the first game. I was on the road in Vancouver. And I had a slight groin injury, so I never did play the first game that the Sharks played, but I was able to play the second one at home in the Cow Palace, which was another experience in its own with 10,000 screaming fans there that, you know, it was incredible just to play in that building, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, you actually led the team in points that year and games played, ironically enough. So, yeah, you may have missed the first game, but you made it up on the back end there by playing in the most of, you know, compared to the rest of your teammates. You actually sat down with Ryan Clark from The Athletic, and you guys talked a little bit about kind of where you're at now And just recently, another expansion team came into the NHL, the Seattle Kraken. And you said you gave advice to Matty Beniers, repeating what Brian Lawton and Doug Wilson, current Sharks general manager and their prized journeyman back in 91, told you as a rookie. And that was, and I quote, "The first thing I would do is look around, find a good veteran who has been around the league and latch on to them. Just take in all the information from someone on that team." So I got to ask you, which veteran did you latch on to your rookie year for the Sharks? And what did they do to help you succeed that amazing rookie year?
Well, that's a piece of cake. For me, it was Brian Lawton. He was the first overall pick in 84. I think it was 84. I can't remember for sure now. But he had been picked up in the expansion draft and ended up, he kind of took me under his wing and we roomed together and he showed me the ropes. You know, he started in the league as an 18-year-old in Minnesota too. And eventually he became a GM in the league as well as a player agent. And I basically just took in everything that he said and tried to, be seen more than heard. You know, didn't need to say much in the dressing room. It was a group of veterans there and just tried to fit in.
What advice did Brian give you? I think he had sort of the unique situation where I believe he was the first American drafted number one.
Yep.
And yourself, you know, just being the first pick of expansion team. So that's a one of a kind of pressure there. So what advice did he give you?
Just not to take anything overly serious. I think, if you listen to what people say or, day in and day out activities, just take things with a grain of salt and learn from your mistakes, basically. I couldn't think of a better guy to show me that than he did. And he's very, very funny guy and very, just kept things loose and kept me on the, well, I wouldn't say straight and narrow, but I mean, kept me focused and it was, and then, as I said, it was a group of veteran guys. There are a lot of veteran guys that looked out for me and was very, it was a special team actually. Yeah.
And speaking of like sort of a not keeping to the straight and narrow, you had an interesting cast of characters there in that first year. Link Gates, of course, you had Doug Wilson there too. So, do you have any stories just pop to your mind? You know about that first year.
No, but too numerous to mention. I think you bring up Link Gates and what a guy Link was. Just a character, and he'd do anything for the team. I don't know if I could think of anyone in particular story. He was a personality, and I think he maybe led the league in penalty minutes or what have you. But there was just numerous, a whole bunch of cast offs really from other teams, guys that were near the end of their careers and trying to get a couple more years in their under their belt and secure their future a little bit. And it was just a fun time, a very close-knit group of guys.
And people forget that not only did you lead the expansion Sharks with 25 goals, but you were really coming on to end of that season. You scored 28 points in your last 22 games. Do you kind of recall that end of the season period, those last 20 games? Did you feel like you were kind of getting it at the NHL level?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was well, I don't know. I guess you can look at it two sides of the coin. We were an expansion team. We weren't expected to make a run for the playoffs or whatnot. We maybe caught some teams by surprise. And George Kinks was a coach, and he played me. I played in the power play, and I played a regular shift. And as the season went on, it just – I just gained more confidence, and you know, was able to put up some numbers, you know, second half of the season for sure.
So what sort of advice would you give to a rookie or a teenager such as, you know, William Eklund, walking into an NHL room right out of his draft year, you know, 18, or in William's case, he's 19 because of his draft year eligibility. You know, what sort of advice would you give to William in his current situation right now?
That's a good question. The league's changed so much. I think it's, you know, basically the same. You just have respect, and you have your ears open all the time, and you go to work every day, and accept advice, work hard, and you know, every day's not going to be the you know, the best. You're going to have your ups and downs, and you know, who knows what might happen with him. He might start off hot. He might not. He might end up sitting for a few games, but you just have to keep things on an even keel.
You know, being that rookie, and you know, you have to kind of keep your head down a little bit and maybe not stand out too much. But, you know, this is the early 90s, though. So did you have any sort of kind of hazing or anything like that? Did you have to buy the team dinner? You know, being the first round pick and all that, you know, maybe you had a little more money than some of the other draft picks. So,
yeah, for sure. You know, at that point in time, it seemed like a whale of cash for me. You know, I was fortunate that time, you know, you were a rookie, and the guys respected us. I think it ended up there's being four or five of us. We had a rookie meal. I think it was in Chicago, and you know, it was maybe $300 or $400 each, or maybe more than that. I don't know, but it seemed like a hell of a lot of money at that time. You know, I can remember that meal, I guess, for some reason. You know, we had Bob McGill was there. He's a D-man. He'd come from, he played in Toronto. We'd been, you know, in the center of the hockey universe for years. And he was a character, and he was looking forward to that rookie team meal. And so being, I don't know what the shots were or whatever, but there's some kind of shots, Louis something, that was, I don't know, $100 or $50 a shot or something. And I don't know how much it was enjoyed, but I know Big Daddy McGill enjoyed it, that's for sure.
Wait a minute, though. You were 19 years old or 18 years old. You weren't supposed to be drinking.
Well, no, I of course I wasn't. I don't know. But that's true. You know, I remember, I think it was my second, third year, I finally turned 21 and I was legal to have a beer in California. And that, you know, at that time it was, you know, I came out of Spokane playing junior, and the owners of that team were the Brett brothers, from, you know, George Brett was part owner of that team. And it so happened that, when I did turn 21, the Royals were playing in Oakland, and, ended up spending a bit of an evening with George Brett after the game. So that's how I remember my 21st birthday, for sure. Before that, I don't know. I guess I probably just got by with my name. I'm not sure.
You can't leave us hanging on that, though. So you spent your 21st birthday with Baseball Hall of Famer George Brett.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if I think and recall a lot of the things that I went through, I just feel like I'm just so fortunate that those things happened to me. You know, at the time I was in awe, and I still am today, of George Brett. But, you know, he at that stage of his career, he was DHing, and, you know, we went out and, you know, had a nothing special, great. But, I mean, I remember sitting at him with a bar and having a drink or two, and he ended up DHing the next day, hit a homer, and I couldn't believe it.
How late did you keep George Brett out that night?
Well, I don't know. Let's just say it was after midnight. And I don't think
past curfew. Next morning.
You're sitting there looking at your watch. Last call already. Wait, what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just said yes, sir, whatever George wanted or needed. And it's just a class act. I don't know. You know, I ran into so many people over the years that just treated me tremendously, and he was certainly another one of those people. Like, I, you know, it's just it's just incredible.
So back into some hockey talk here, per se. We'd love to just sit here and talk about who you had beers with those first couple years for the Sharks. Right. But, you know, the following season, your sophomore year, even before the shoulder injury, right, you were off to, I would say, a relatively slow start, a slower start than the prior season, 28 right. points in 41 games. So what do you think may have happened early there? Do you think maybe your scoring prowess in the first season, maybe someone had a target painted on your back? They're putting the shutdown line out there against you?
Yeah, maybe, I guess a little bit. I don't know. I notoriously was not a great starter. You know, with October, November, my stats never really that good. I usually was a little better come the new season after Christmas or whatever. And I ended up, I was voted to play in the All-Star game, and we're in Ottawa and got hit, dislocated my shoulder. And that was the end of my season. And I don't blame anything in my career on that, but you know, that's just another turning point. As it turned out, Kelly Kissio was able to go that year, and he just had an incredible season. He ended up getting another contract out of it and playing in Calgary. And, you know, overall, you know, 14 goals in 41 games wasn't too bad. It's a funny league, you know. You're hot and cold, you're streaky, and so was the case, I guess, that year.
Yeah, and for the Sharks specifically, as a team, a little bit colder than hot in those first couple of years, you know, being the expansion team that they were, they didn't get the glorious expansion draft rules as, let's say, Vegas and Seattle have gotten right. these last couple of years. So, you know, even though you had that personal success with San Jose, the first couple of years, they were rough for the team. You guys just won 28 of 164 games in those first 2 years. So every victory was hard earned. We know that for a fact.
Right.
So did any of the losing affect your game personally? I would think not, but they talk about how players can gain habits when losing. Did that happen to you at all, especially being more, you know, younger and more impressionable at that age?
I guess it's you know, it's an atmosphere, you know, and anything you do when winning or losing, it, you know, you can get some bad habits, or you can fall into a, you know, some self-pity moments and mm-hmm. shit like that. But it was second year was really a tough year. It was you know, I think we broke records for losses, and you know, it was hard to keep a positive mindset at points, but that being said, you know, you learn from those things too, you know, in not just in hockey, but in life. You know, you're not going to win every day you go out and play. Mm-hmm. So overall, I guess it was more of a learning experience, and I happened to be hurt for the last half of the year and watched it from up above. But I mean, we still have guys that year that had great seasons, and Kelly Kissio and Robbie Gaudreau had a great season. I think he almost scored 30 goals, and Davey Bruce. And so there's always positives when you look back to stuff that's not really, you know, great. If you look in the standings, wasn't that pretty to see, for sure. Mm-hmm.
On a day-to-day, how tough was that, though? You know, you have great leaders there, like a Doug Wilson or a Kelly Kissio you mentioned. You know, guys who are trying to stay positive, but it's got to be tough. They're trying to stay positive, but you guys are seeing the results, right? And so right. just day-to-day, just how tough is that?
Well, it wasn't easy. You know, it's just a fact. You know, you look at that team the second year, there's a handful of guys that have gone on to be GMs in this league or coaches, you know, I think of Dean Evason and you know, guys like that who just persevered, you know, Paul Fenton, you know, Brian Hayward, and that, like, there was a lot of character built from that, whether you can look at it how you want. But I think if you ask any guy that played on that team, they'll remember it for more of a learning curve than a negative thing.
What did you learn from it?
That I hate losing. Well, I knew it's you know, why play the game, right? If you know, they keep score, so you might as well win it. But it's, you know, brings out the personality in everyone. You know, you learn about people, you learn about yourself, more importantly, there's not too many guys that just go through the career and never lose.
Right. And, you know, going, sticking with that second year, and of course you did have that injury, you dislocated your right shoulder, and right. You've said that you still have, you never regained your range of motion there.
Right.
And I know that, you know, you don't want to necessarily blame that or associate that with what happened with your career. But I have to ask you, why was that not fixed properly back then? I mean,
well, I'm not saying it wasn't fixed properly.
Okay.
You know, it was a question at the time that was, you know, made. I mean, you can look at Jack Eichel right now. You know,
right.
He's sitting out. He's not playing. He's, you know, they're indecisive on what mode of, you know, what they want to do. And the poor kid's missing the year of hockey. And, you know, for me, I took the advice of our management and our doctors, and in my opinion, they did the best job they could.
Mm-hmm.
I don't blame lack of success or anything due to that. I mean, you suck it up, right? You carry on. I had a good rehabilitation, and I probably could have played at the end of that year, but I ended up not. So can't change it now. So it's done and it's over. And you know, I just, you know, you see it all the time. You see it in every sport. You know, it's hard to judge what each individual body is going to react to a certain injury or you know, how it's going to recuperate.
And I guess you had the option then. You could have also let it rehabilitate on its own, I guess, instead of surgery.
Yeah, I could have done that too. You know, but I didn't, and it is what it is. So I don't know. I'm happy. I'm probably one of the luckiest guys in the world, in my opinion. If I could look in the mirror every day and be thankful for what I accomplished and
sure.
what I learned and what I did, and you know, I can still carry on a normal life.
Yeah, and you went drinking with George Brett when you were 21 too, so that's amazing.
Sure George doesn't remember that, but
I'm sure he doesn't. But I also wanted to ask you one more question about this, but more related to Jack Eichel, since you bring him up. You know, I think the crux of the whole Eichel debate is that Eichel wants to do something and the team wants him to do something else.
Right.
And obviously you, as a former player, you might align more with Jack, but just what are your general thoughts about that? Because, you know, for you, you kind of took the team's advice. You know, Jack doesn't want to hear, but just what are your general thoughts about that sort of player versus team debate?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, you have to look at both sides, I guess. I respect both sides. You know, it's a tough choice to make. I think it's a bigger injury than I had. It's mm-hmm. it's more, and of course he's, you know, you have to weigh your options. You don't know how long your career is going to be. You know, in this day and age, you don't. You have to look, I think, in the future a little bit. And as the team, you want, you know, this is the guy you drafted. You want him to be healthy and you want him to play for you and you want him to produce. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out, whether it lasts half a year, all the year, or if he gets traded and goes somewhere and carries on with his career.
And actually, it sparked one more question about it. Just for yourself, if you had just chosen to rehabilitate it, what would that have meant for you? Like, would you have missed more time, or just why was the option chosen for surgery instead of just rehabilitating it?
I think for it, at that point, it was for a long-term fix. We weren't just thinking. I probably could have rehabilitated and been back in the lineup in a month or 6 weeks. But as we discussed earlier, that second year, I think by the time middle of January, end of January rolled around, we were probably odds of making the playoffs were very slim.
Sure.
So, in everybody's opinion, it was that I got a good surgery and rehabilitated and was ready to go for the next year. I think that was the main reason why I didn't do nothing and just, because my shoulder would have kept, probably would have been dislocated again, as things went by, and then I would have been out of the lineup again. And this was something that was going to hopefully at that point, cure an injury and enable me to have a long career, productive career.
And I guess one more question, but more related to William Eklund. And you suffered your injury as a teenager, and the NHL is a tough league for teenagers. Maybe the body isn't fully developed. Do you think that might have something to do with it, or was it just kind of on bad luck for you, kind of,
Well, a combination. I think, yeah, at 1920, you're still probably, growing stature wise or muscular wise, and yeah, it's just an unfortunate thing. It happens every day. It happens to people whether they're playing hockey or playing any sport, and I guess just I really don't know how to describe it. It was just the luck of the draw. Just I guess things that's just the way it was meant to happen.
And you said before you're not going to make any excuses. You love your life now as it is. And as a scorer for you, Pat, how did that injury affect you specifically? Because you were known for having a great release. That's what your scouting report said. That's why the Sharks loved you so much. Well, yeah, we checked the scouting report, Pat. Don't worry.
Well,
We
you
did
did.
our research.
You guys probably weren't even around in 91.
No, I was negative
I
three
was.
years old, Pat. Don't worry.
I was, Pat.
You weren't even a sparkle in your mom's or dad's eyes.
Nope, not at all. Not at all. But back to the question, how did that injury affect your game specifically and how you played hockey?
Well, just more physically than anything. I don't think it affected maybe the shot a little bit, but just more of the physical game. I think, I always had a, I had to go into situations, knowing that, I had to play a wee bit differently, but as far as shooting the puck, it didn't affect me that much at all, I don't think. Yeah, just basically, I guess, just the physical part of the game a little bit would be the only thing.
And the next year, 1993-94, the Sharks did find some success with Kevin Constantine, but was it tough to play for Kevin, though? His style was a lot different, to put it, kindly, than the previous coaches.
Yeah, he had his own style. It was a little different. I mean, to each their own. We ended up going to we almost ended up into the third round of the playoffs. We had I have no idea where he might be now, to be honest, but he had his style, and it ended up that it was time for me to move on, and so be it. I ended up going to Philly and just came within a whisker of winning the Stanley Cup, so that wasn't bad news at all either.
Why didn't maybe your styles mesh, you and Kevin's?
I think he's more of a defensive style. He a little less of using your imagination, I guess would be the word. More of a structured style, which is fine too, unless you're you I don't know. It's hard to say. I haven't really I haven't thought about that for years, to be honest.
Well, like I said, we've done our research, so.
Well, for sure, yeah.
But I guess, you know, in terms of that imagination, though, you guys did have Larionov, you guys had Makarov, and right. those guys, from what I understand, were kind of allowed to do their own thing, Garpenlov and Norton. Yep. So were you a little bit jealous kind of watching them that they were kind of, you know, let off the leash a little bit, I guess, so to speak?
I was in awe, to be honest, watching those guys play. Larionov, Makarov, Garpenlov. There was a five-man unit there with Jeff Norton, Santos Ozlinch. And they played their own style and learned a lot from watching just those guys play. You know, it was a puck possession game. And, you know, they wouldn't give it up. I wasn't jealous at all. I just had probably the best seat in the world to watch them play. And, you know, just to be a part of that was good. And, of course, you know, who's going to tell Igor Larionov that he changed his game? You know, he's a Hall of Famer. He's probably one of the top 10 players to play the game that I've played with.
Why don't teams do that more, just that kind of that five-man unit? Detroit also did that with Larionov. And is it just hard to find five players that mesh as well as they did in Detroit, the Russian five, and as well as they did with San Jose, those five?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's hard to, you know, on the pace of the game now with guys, you know, if you see a guy out there taking a full-minute shift, it's like, out of the ordinary. If you're 30 to 45 seconds, that's the norm. And, you know, there's more, seems to me anyway, there's more penalties and more, I don't know. It's just not the same. It was a thing that happened. And, you know, I got to see the bad end of it too, when I went to the finals with Philly and Detroit had the five-man unit, all the Russians. So,
right.
It was, yeah, who knows? But it might come around again. It might be like Crocs or something. I don't know.
You know, you talked on record before about how the only regret that you may have had was how you trained and yep. prepared. You know, back in the 90s was a chaotic era. There was grunge music. Yeah. There was Jeanco jeans. You know, the world was in pure chaos back then.
I agree.
It was a different time. You know, yeah. You even spoke about guys eating pizza and drinking beers after games. And you also said your eyes were quite opened by Rod Brind'Amour in Philly yeah. after when you went over to Philly. Did anybody in San Jose train like Rod?
Oh yeah, I mean, I roomed with Dougie Wilson on the road. He was in incredible shape. You know, okay. he, a lot of guys and did that. I mean, and then there's both sides of the coin. You know, played with Tony Herkus. The first time he put his skates on was training camp. You know, never skated all summer. He'd go out there and he's the best skilled guy that we had on our team, basically. You know, he's a Hobie Baker winner, and you know, so it was. I'd seen it, but I hadn't seen anything like Rod Brind'Amour when I went to Philly. He's, you know, I'm sure if you did your research on him, you would come to the conclusion pretty quick that he's an incredible man, a freak of nature almost, and just work ethic that you can't even fathom.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's in better shape now than half the league, probably.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't argue that for one second.
But what do you think your career might have been like if you had maybe taken on maybe if you had been introduced to a Rod Brind'Amour when you were a teenager and taken on the Rod the Bod routine?
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't even want to think about that. But, yeah, I know some guys play like you talk about the Russian, the five. You know, watching Sergei Makarov out there, I could tell you right now, he probably wasn't the best, fittest athlete that you're ever going to see.
But yeah, I've read that.
Probably you could knock him off your skates if you tried. You could try and run him over with a truck, and he would not go down.
Yeah, so some of that is just natural too. No, I gotcha.
Yeah, for sure.
You also mentioned too rooming with Doug Wilson. Doug Wilson, who is going to be going to the Hockey Hall of Fame this year.
Right.
Just what are some of your memories of rooming with Doug?
Oh, just a class act. Taught me a lot. You know, just the little ins and outs, the little things that you learn from, you know, just being on the road and how to manage yourself and you know, he just had the utmost respect for him, still do. Very, very rewarding, you know, that he's going to the Hall of Fame. Much due for him. You know, I still in awe of him, to be honest. You know, it was incredible just to have him there and to learn from him.
I'm going to guess that you don't have a drinking with Doug Wilson story like you have a drinking with George Brett story.
Well, you'll have to ask Doug Wilson that question. I've sworn to oath.
Well, one Doug Wilson story that I can tell you, I spoke with David Millay or somebody on my website, spoke with David Millay some time ago, and he told me the story of you, Doug Wilson,
right,
and Michael Jordan.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was – well, Scottie Pippen was there too.
Was that story all true? Because that sounded like that was something that David just spun out, and you guys were there for the LeBradford-Smith game. And if you guys don't know the LeBradford-Smith game, anyone who's listening, you got to look it up. Basically, this punk rookie kid supposedly said something to Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan got offended, and the next game, Michael dropped 40 points in the first half on him. As it turns out, though, LeBradford-Smith never said anything to Michael Jordan, and Jordan just made it all up. But
yeah, well, he did get 40 points in that first half, and I was there to see it, and I, to this day, I'm still in awe that I even met the man. He, you know, that was all due to Doug Wilson. You know, I was just ended up and there after the basketball game is Michael Jordan, and I don't think I said boo. I was like a fly on the wall. Just incredible.
And I guess that was a Doug Wilson's nickname in Chicago parts. It was Willie.
Yep. Yeah. You know, I guess between him and then I guess Chelios took over after that. So Chicago's always had a good representative, you know, as far as hockey goes, you know, just class acts. I never did get to meet Chris Chelios yet, but you know, from all I've heard, just incredible. You know, anybody who could play that long in the league and you know, just so, you know, and what a city too. Like it was something else.
And the story that David Millay tells about the Jordan story, told to Ryan Cowley on San Jose Hockey Now, was that, you know, you guys got tickets to the game because of Doug Wilson, and then after the game, you're waiting for Michael Jordan to come out. And you know, when he comes out, it's not just him; it's not him and his entourage. It's just MJ.
It was just MJ and Scottie Pippen.
Yeah, Scottie Pippen. Yeah. So, what was it like meeting those guys? And I guess seeing, I guess they knew Doug Wilson. And so, what was it like, I guess, watching them ham it up?
Well, it was, like I said, I was just a fly at the wall. I felt like I was like a size of a mosquito, to be honest. I could not believe the size of the height of these guys. And, you know, it was, to this day, I still, you know, I got it's crazy. But yeah, just, you know, that's probably one of the best athletes to ever play sports. And that's unarguable, right?
Right.
Yes.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of another of your former teammates and, you know, your friend, too, Ray Whitney.
Sure.
And always wondered, because things also did not work out for Ray Whitney and the Sharks, just like maybe they didn't quite work out for you and the Sharks.
Right.
And I know that Ray left the Sharks a couple years after you did, but, you know, from your perspective, why didn't it work out for Ray and the Sharks?
Well, I don't think it really matters. I think it was best thing to happen to Ray. You know, he went on, he had an incredible career on the verge of being a Hall of Famer. Actually, I feel and won a Stanley Cup, and just a class act. I was fortunate to play junior with him before we even went to San Jose, and,
right.
and you know, just a great guy. And how we ended up not or leaving San Jose. I mean, that's a story that, I mean, you can go to every team and pick out a few guys that just needed maybe a change of address, you know, a new lease on life, and you know, an upstart. He certainly proved that.
Well, Pat, I just want to thank you very much for your time. And just closing out with just a couple questions here. Just in general, talking this last half hour or so, any other shark stories spark up that you want to kind of share? Anything that you can open up the closet to?
We can put a warning. Hey, by the way, if you have children in the car, fast forward this bit.
Well, no, I just, I don't know. I wouldn't know where to start. I, you know, there's just numerous things. I guess you'd have to ask Dougie Wilson. I can't. I'm sworn to oath about anything.
with
him on the road, so I'll leave it at that.
You've seen probably Doug in interviews as a GM. He's very tight-lipped. You know, you can't be a general manager for so long if you don't know when to, you know, when to hold him, when to fold him, right?
That's right. You know, you got to play your cards close to your chest. So, yeah, it's just the way it is, boys. So you just
understand. Yeah. Well, one I got to ask you about, and this story made me laugh. And it's something that Rob Zettler said on another podcast, the Teal Town podcast. And Rob Zettler said that outside of the Cal Palace locker room, a Sharks player was growing a marijuana plant.
What?
And so it is my sworn duty as a Sharks beat reporter to one day find out whose plant that was.
Well, it wasn't mine, I don't think, anyway. But, yeah, I could probably tell you, but then I'd have to shoot you or something. So
you can.
No, we can't be doing that. No, that reminds me. If it wasn't for him, I would have led the world in plus or minus there the one year. But you know, another thing Dougie Wilson said was about me: the only time that I was in our end is when they played the national anthem before the game.
What was it? Zettler who led in minus that year?
I think it was the one year. Yeah, I was.
Right. Oh.
Somehow he happened to have the fortunate thing of being on the ice for a couple more goals against. But that just, you know, that's the worst stat in hockey. Depends what side you're on, right?
Right. And I guess I had to. Do you know whose plant it was? You're just not saying, or you don't recall that?
No,
being...
I don't. You know, that's just, it's a foggy memory. So I,
okay.
You know, I can't admit or deny anything that I would know about that.
Foggy from too much intake?
No.
The plant is now a foggy memory for someone as well.
Oh, I think maybe it's the concussions. I'm not sure. But...
All right. Well, I'm going to dig it up one day. So, yeah. So every time we have a Sharks alumni, not the plant. No, the plant is has long been smoked. But
yeah, I'm sure long gone through anyone by now.
Long gone, long bong. So
yeah, long bong for sure. Yeah.
But... I'm going to, every time we have an original Shark, I'm going to ask that question. Right. So I'm going to keep working on it until I whittle away on it. But Pat, it's been such a pleasure having you here. I assume you'll be watching this Saturday. It's, you know, your hometown team and against your first team. And ironically, of course, we want to talk to you because of William Eklund, and he's going to be making his debut. So have you actually watched any of his highlights or anything so far?
No, I have not, but I will tomorrow, and I'll watch the game Saturday for sure.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, love to hear your thoughts about, you know, another teenage phenom like yourself joining the Sharks.
For sure. Wish them all the best, and the Sharks too.
Yeah, thanks again, Pat, again for, you know, taking time to sit down with us, talk hockey, drinking stories, marijuana stories, everything in between.
Tip of the iceberg, and, boys, tip of the iceberg. Yeah.
You know, I think I speak for most Sharks fans when I say, you know, thank you for helping pave the way for future generations of Sharks players. And, you know, it had to start somewhere. And you being that first pick for the Sharks, you helped set the precedent for what it takes and what it means to be a San Jose Shark. So thank you again, Pat, for everything that you did for the organization and, of course, for sitting down and talking to us. Maybe we'll go off the record one day and do a little bit more deeper dive. Well,
the fans in San Jose deserve a Stanley Cup there, too, one day, and it'll happen. It's just a matter of time. You know, loyal fans, incredible. You know, still the best building that I ever played in. You know, as far as fan goes, when it comes to the playoffs, they're just incredible, and they are they're gonna be there, and they're gonna enjoy it when they do win it.
Yeah, I will be there, I promise you, and I will be just as faded as you were when you just turned 21. So
sounds great, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Pat. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Big thank you to Pat Falloon for hopping on the podcast and sharing some amazing stories and memories with us about his time with the Sharks and all the fun off the ice he had, especially with Doug Wilson.
And I ran into Doug Wilson recently, and I begged him to confirm the Michael Jordan story. Obviously, Pat Falloon confirmed it. David Millay told the story on San Jose Hockey Now some time ago. And I'm going to keep pulling at Doug and see if I get a few more details about Willie.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't even know that his nickname was Willie until you told me that. So the more secrets come out. I mean, even Pat Falloon said he swore an oath to not say anything. So, you know, there's some good stuff out there about Doug. So we'll see if that ever comes to fruition. But I think that does it for our final preseason, off-season training camp episode of this hockey season. We're finally going to be able to next week talk about regular season Sharks, Shang Pang. It's been a long time, but
yep,
it's about damn time. So everyone, again, just a quick reminder, if you are going to the game, which I hope to see as many of you as I can, Shang will be waving from the rafters, make sure you have your Clear app set up. Make sure everything's taken care of on your verification of vaccination on that side. So that way we can speed up the process and there's no one left kind of in a tizzy, because we all want to enjoy the Sharks game together. So make sure you guys are all signed up for that. I think that pretty much wraps it up for us, Shang, unless you have something else for the folks to listen to or know. Anything coming up on San Jose Hockey Now? You're going to put a teaser out there for the listeners?
Just the best Sharks coverage out there.
Yep, that's undeniable. Can't argue with that one. That's going to do it for us today. Make sure that you all take care of yourselves, stay safe, and stay hydrated.